Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. The Obama administration is abandoning efforts to train Syrian rebel forces to fight Islamic State militants and switching to a strategy of equipping and enabling a select group of vetted opposition leaders and units. A Pentagon statement acknowledged challenges in the original $500 million program to train and arm moderate Syrian forces in Syria. The program has produced only a handful of rebels who joined the fight against IS. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter spoke Friday in London.
We have been looking for now several weeks at ways to improve that program. I wasn't satisfied with the early efforts in that regard, and so we're looking at different ways to achieve basically the same kind of strategic objective, which is the right one, which is to enable capable, motivated forces on the ground to retake territory from ISIL and reclaim Syrian territory from extremism.
Carter said the work the United States has done with Kurdish forces in northern Syria is one example of an effective approach. Tehran said Friday a senior Iranian Revolutionary Guards commander was killed in Syria as French warplanes carried out fresh airstrikes in the country. The guard said General Hossein Hamadani was killed by Islamic State fighters earlier this week while advising Syrian troops in the northern region of Aleppo. Shiite Iran is a key regional ally of Syria. It's provided military and political support for beleaguered President Bashar al-Assad. This is VOA News. The 2015 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet for its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the waking of the Jasmine Revolution of 2011. The Nobel Prize Committee in Oslo, Norway, announced the prize Friday, crediting the quartet for stabilizing the country at a time when it had reached the brink of civil war. It established a peaceful political process after efforts at democratization following the Arab Spring that were undermined by political assassinations and social unrest. Kasi Kuhlman Fuva made the announcement in Oslo, Norway.
The quartet exercised its role as a mediator and driving force to advance peaceful democratic development in Tunisia with great moral authority.
The Nobel Prize Committee noted that the prize goes to the four organizations combined, not to individual groups, for their work establishing a peaceful political process after efforts at democratization following the Arab Spring that were undermined by political assassinations and social unrest. The UN Security Council passed a resolution Friday to authorize the European Union and other countries to board, search, and seize vessels suspected of human trafficking in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya. The 15-member council adopted the measure drafted by Britain to counter the worst refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. 14 member countries voted in favor, with Venezuela abstaining. The Council adopted the resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorizes use of force, but it limits its mandate to 1 year. It neither authorizes action in Libyan territorial waters nor on the country's coast. Israeli troops fired across the border into the Gaza Strip Friday, killing at least four Palestinians and wounding more than a dozen others as tensions between the two sides surged. Israel's military said about 200 Palestinians in Gaza advanced on the border during a demonstration and threw rocks and rolled burning tires toward soldiers stationed on the other side. It said forces opened fire on the main instigators to stop their advance. U.S. President Barack Obama begins a four-day visit to the West Coast Friday by meeting with the families of victims of last week's mass shooting in Roseburg, Oregon. Mr. Obama is set to meet with the families of the 8 students and one instructor gunned down at Umpqua Community College last Thursday by a gunman, Christopher Harper Mercer, who then took his own life. Protests are expected during the president's visit. Mr. Obama has been calling for stronger gun control laws in the aftermath of the shooting. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for its work in supporting the country's democratization process in the wake of the so-called Jasmine Revolution of 2011.
That's VOA's Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reporting. Details coming up. Also in the news, three West African countries are still celebrating their first week without any new cases of the deadly Ebola virus. And campaigning began today in Ivory Coast ahead of a crucial presidential election on October 25th. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization reports that a patient who died at the University of Calabar Teaching Hospital in southern Nigeria did not have Ebola. Hospital officials quarantined staff and others as a precaution until lab tests confirmed there was no Ebola virus in the patient's blood. No new cases of Ebola were found during the latest reporting period for Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Liberia already has been declared Ebola-free, while Sierra Leone and Guinea recently started their 42-day countdown to being declared Ebola-free. More than 11,000 people died of the virus in an epidemic that began with the death of a 2-year-old boy in Guinea in December 2013. More than 28,000 were infected. Medical experts now warn that many who were diagnosed and survived Ebola may be long-term reservoirs for the virus. They say the virus can hide in the eyes, breasts, and testicles long after it has left the bloodstream. They cite the case of a Scottish nurse who had recovered from Ebola 9 months ago in Sierra Leone. However, she is now suffering of complications of the disease. Researchers warn of the long-term risks of having been infected, calling it post-Ebola syndrome. Officials at London's Royal Free Hospital say complications for the 29-year-old nurse are serious. And campaigning began today in Ivory Coast ahead of a crucial presidential election on October 25th. No one is expecting a repeat of the 2009-2010 post-election, but things are getting off to a tense start. Only four of the 10 candidates agreed to sign a code of good conduct this week. Emilia Yub reports from Abidjan.
Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara symbolically chose Yemma Sucre, the hometown of the country's popular first president, to kick off his electoral campaign. Ouattara is running for his second 5-year term and is widely seen as the frontrunner in the election planned for October 25th. The poll is crucial for the country as post-election violence in 2010 killed more than 3,000 people. Earlier this week, presidential candidates were invited to sign a code of good conduct prepared by an American NGO, the National Democratic Institute. One of the speakers read it out.
Nous nous engageons à sensibiliser nos militants.
The signatory pledged to raise awareness among their supporters of the code of good conduct and on the necessity to use dialogue and all peaceful and legal means in order to settle the disagreements, she says. But only four of the 10 candidates approved by the Constitutional Court showed up to sign that pledge. On the same day, on the other side of Abidjan, the opposition coalition, known as CNC, was holding a meeting and insisting, as it has done for weeks, that conditions are not right for a free and fair election. On Thursday, CNC spokesperson Jean-Jacques Béchiot repeated that claim.
Comment voulez-vous qu'on mette en place une commission électorale dite indépendante?
He says the Independent Electoral Commission is only independent in name and that there is nothing wrong in asking for its dissolution in order to recompose a new, fair commission. The CNC says the commission is biased in favor of President Ouattara and that basic security conditions have not been met. The opposition coalition has said it may boycott the election if no changes are made. A few days ago, one of the candidates, Amara Essi, suspended his participation to the poll for the same reasons. The electoral campaign is due to last until October 23rd, 2 days prior to the first round of the election. Emilia for VOA News from Abidjan.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, welcomes the start of a European Union relocation scheme with the departure of a first group of asylum seekers today from Italy to Sweden. The High Commissioner says he hopes to build on this asylum program during a 2.5-day mission to Greece. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
High Commissioner Guterres is set to begin his mission on Saturday on the Greek island of Lesbos. This is the main entry point for most of the more than 428,000 people who have crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Turkey this year. He will meet with political leaders in Athens on Sunday and Monday. The aim of his trip is to assess the humanitarian response to the Mediterranean crisis and see how best to support these efforts. He says Greece alone cannot handle the overwhelming number of refugees and migrants coming mainly from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
This is a European crisis, and it needs a European response. There is no way this can be solved on a country-by-country basis.
High Commissioner Guterres says the overwhelming numbers of people arriving in Europe are creating tension and chaotic conditions for many countries. At the same time, he adds, this is a horrible experience for those arriving. He tells VOA the only way to avoid this situation is to address it seriously at the entry point. He says it is essential to have effective reception conditions to receive the thousands of people who are arriving. The UNHCR has just wrapped up a week-long international refugee conference which examined crisis situations in many parts of the world. Guterres says caring for 60 million refugees, asylum seekers, and displaced people around the world is a daunting prospect. He says it is difficult to interest countries in refugees, but with the recent media attention to this issue, he says refugees now figure high on the political agenda of many countries. He says conference participants recognize this is creating opportunities for aid agencies to address the plight of refugees as never before. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Security Council today authorized European naval operations for 1 year to seize and dispose of vessels operated by human traffickers in the high seas of Libya. The resolution allows the European Union's Operation Sophia, a fleet of naval vessels with helicopter and drone support, to seize vessels being used by smugglers to transport migrants on the international waters of the Mediterranean. EU officials say they cannot enter Libyan waters where most of the Mediterranean smuggling occurs. A spokesperson told VOA they must first receive official approval from the Libyan government. The death toll continues to rise from last month's stampede at the Hajj in Saudi Arabia. The Associated Press reports 1,453 people died on September 24th in Mina, near Mecca. That's the highest figure ever recorded for such a tragedy. However, Saudi Arabia maintains the death toll is 769 and 934 injured. Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for its work in supporting the country's democratization process in the wake of the so-called Jasmine Revolution of 2011. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
The announcement came Friday in Oslo from Kasi Kullmann-Fiva, head of the Nobel Committee.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2015 is to be awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet for its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the Jasmine Revolution of 2011.
The quartet is made up of labor unions as well as the Tunisian Human Rights League and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. Kullmann-Fiva said the group started its work at a time when Tunisia's fragile democratization process was in danger of collapsing as a result of political assassinations and social unrest.
It established an alternative, peaceful political process at a time when the country was on the brink of civil war.
Tunisia was the site of the first popular uprisings in 2011, known as the Arab Spring. Tunisians took to the streets and forced the departure of longtime President Zain El Abidine Ben Ali in hopes of ending decades of autocratic rule and corruption. By many accounts, Tunisia is the Arab Spring's only success story. While Egypt and Libya plunged into political turmoil and Syria descended into an all-out civil war, Tunisia carried out a nonviolent election process in which voters last year handed victory to a secular political party. But questions remain on how sustainable the gains will be as the country continues to struggle with corruption, a 35% unemployment rate among young people, and the recruitment of thousands of young Tunisians by extremists, including the Islamic State group. The United States this year pledged hundreds of millions of dollars in additional aid and more cooperation to bolster the fledgling democracy. During a visit by Tunisia's president to Washington in May, President Obama designated the country as a major non-NATO ally of the United States, making it possible for Tunisia to receive more military aid. The Nobel Committee on Friday said it hopes Tunisia will serve as an example for other countries. This year's list of 273 contenders was among the longest ever for the Peace Prize and included Pope Francis as well as German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
Past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new study says the climate may not be kind to the Horn of Africa in the coming years. It says conditions could become even drier and warmer for Somalia, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. However, the new findings dispute computer models that say the region will get wetter. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Droughts are already common in the Horn of Africa, threatening food security and contributing to humanitarian crises. And they're coming more often. The study warns that progressively less rain during the long rain season in March, April, and May could exacerbate tensions in one of the world's most geopolitically unstable regions. Researchers base their findings in part on evaluation of ancient marine sediments in the Gulf of Aden, off the Somali coast. The sediments reveal what the regional climate was like over the last 2,000 years. This field of science is called paleoclimatology, the study of the effect of climate changes during the entire history of the Earth. University of Arizona Associate Professor Jessica Tierney is the lead author of the study. She says sediment from the 20th century showed the Horn of Africa getting drier. That's actually at odds with what computers have to say.
The climate models that are predicting future climate changes in the Horn all predict that it'll get wetter. So there's sort of a fundamental disconnect from what we're seeing and what the models suggest will happen in the future. So our paper is a lot about diagnosing why that is the case and what we think will really happen. And we kind of come down on the side of thinking that the drying is what we will expect as greenhouse gases rise.
Researchers expected their findings to confirm the computer model predictions. Tierney suggests one reason for the discrepancy.
Some of the predictions from the models might be due to the difficulty that the models have in simulating rainfall in this particular region of Africa.
Whether the Horn gets much drier or wetter, the impact will be big.
If it gets much wetter, like the models suggest, then we could see situations where we've got flooding, too much water, and then if it gets much drier, of course, that has major implications for drought, famine, food security.
She says the Gulf of Aden sediment indicates that the rate of recent drying in the Horn of Africa is unprecedented in the last 2,000 years.
We can calculate the rate of the changes that have happened before. About 300 years ago, it was quite a bit wetter than today, and then before that, it was actually drier, sort of similar to today. But what's different about the 20th century is if you look at how fast the change from wet to dry has been occurring, we haven't seen such a fast transition like that in the last 1,000 years at least. So when we say unprecedented in the context of the data that we just generated from these sediment cores.
Tierney says the rapid drying appears linked to the rise in greenhouse gases.
As we increase greenhouse gases, we're potentially driving a very rapid change in the hydrological cycle in the Horn of Africa, and that's pushing the whole region towards a drier and drier state. What we don't know everything about is exactly how that works on the ground. That's a question that now we're really looking into as a follow-up on the study, is really getting into the why.
The University of Arizona associate professor says, despite the long-term drying, there will be variability in some years.
We'll have wet years and we'll have dry years, just like any other time. So there will be variability on top of that. So it's not to say that suddenly every single year will be a drought year, but what we could see is a higher frequency of prolonged droughts that might, in sort of the average sense, make the region dry. But of course, we'll still see year-to-year variability.
The big question, she says, is whether the years that are wetter will actually provide enough rain to support agriculture. Sediment has been used before to learn about Africa's climate. For example, a study of the Sahara showed the region was once thick with vegetation. But about 5,000 years ago, a rapid drying out began. The vegetation was gone in less than 200 years. Researchers say it indicates climate shifts can happen relatively quickly. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists are questioning whether ecotourism may actually put some wildlife at greater risk of being eaten by predators. They say frequent contact with humans may hinder their survival instincts. A new article in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution says it's time to find out. The principal author is Daniel Blumstein, professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California in Los Angeles. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
Right now, we don't know the magnitude of this problem, but what we've done in this review is based on an extensive review and sort of a new way of thinking about the relationships between domestication and urbanization and tourism. We believe we've identified a pathway by which the more people are exposed to animals in ecotourist situations, the more likely animals are to let down their guard. And this could translate into increased vulnerability when the tourists go away and real predators come back in. So what happens when tourists come to an area, a human shield is created, meaning that predators might be more afraid of people than the prey species are. And what this means is the prey species, if they get accustomed to people, then might be less wary when real predators come back in. We believe that we have a plausible pathway by which ecotourism could increase vulnerability to the wildlife that we're all interested in seeing. And we need to better understand and study this phenomena.
How would you propose the kind of study that would show this?
Going out, following individually marked animals, looking at how they respond when real predators, you know, come through. We know, for example, that at certain species, ecotourists and guides try to habituate wild animals to people. So, for example, chimpanzees and gorillas that people go to visit in East and Central Africa are habituated to humans, meaning that even on days when tourists aren't there, guides are out there hanging out with the animals, making them accustomed to people and training them, basically, that people are not harmful. We also know these very animals suddenly become vulnerable to poachers. Now, poachers are very different than, say, a real predator coming in. And the question is, to what extent do prey species transfer their habituation from people to real predators? What we've done with this paper is really highlight a series of questions that we believe should be asked and can be asked to better understand the effect of us going out and looking at animals and enjoying nature might have potentially deleterious effects this might have on the animals that we go out to see.
You had mentioned that there are 8 billion visitors to protected areas, and you also talk about ecotourism. Are all these 8 billion visitors ecotourists?
No, that's a really good distinction. There's nature-based tourism where people are just going outside and you know, experiencing nature. Ecotourists, in theory, are doing things to help preserve, make sustainable nature. Ecotourism, strictly defined, is supposed to be a good tourism. Nature-based tourism is just we love going outside and doing things, and we go to protected areas to do this, and we go to non-protected areas to do this as well.
And what are the most important questions that you need to ask, particularly in terms of African wildlife?
African wildlife is an interesting one because, you know, we've all seen on YouTube the videos of people in tourist buses having lions, you know, sitting on top of the vehicles. We've all seen in YouTube animals getting killed in front of tourists. How common is that? Are the prey species letting down their guard because the ecotourists are around? I don't know. But, you know, much tourism doesn't happen in Africa. I mean, people are certainly going to Africa to be ecotourists, but a lot of ecotourism happens in our backyards where we have neighborhood parks or reserves or smaller nature reserves. So it's not simply let's understand this phenomena in Africa or Yellowstone or the big national parks, but many people are going to smaller reserves. And is ecotourism essentially leading to an urbanization-like phenomena? We know there are consequences of urbanization on certain animals, and we know now that really that's one of the very interesting things happening right now is that carnivores are working their way back into cities after years of not being around. So what are the consequences of this for the prey? Similarly, if initially predators may avoid people or shun people when they start using an area, what happens when they come back to the prey? These are questions I think we need to ask.
That was Professor Daniel Blumstein at the University of California in Los Angeles. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold. For the past week, many people in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been discussing a rare public speech that President Joseph Kabila made Sunday at a meeting of his ruling coalition, the AMP. VOA's Nick Long has more from Goma in the Eastern DRC.
The president was reacting to a public letter written by seven political parties last month in which they warned him against trying to stay in power beyond his constitutional two-term limit. Days after the letter appeared, the seven parties known as the G7 were expelled from the AMP. But speaking over the weekend, the president suggested the constitution is not an issue. I don't remember, Kabila says, having organized a meeting with the majority to raise the question of revising the constitution. I never raised that question, he adds. According to some media, his remarks imply that he will respect the constitution and the AMP will soon choose another candidate for the elections in November 2016. Opposition UNC party spokesman Stefan Mashukano in Goma does not agree. If they needed to win the elections, they would have presented a successor already, he says. But that's an internal problem for them, which is why the G7 left. If the president really wanted to stop all the rumors, why does he not state clearly, I will not be standing at the next elections? A spokesman for the president's party in Goma, Paluku Muhaya, told VOA that the majority still has a year in which to choose a candidate, and the president will respect the constitution. One of Kabila's supporters, North Kivu Governor Julien Paluku, described the G7 parties at a rally this week as rats abandoning ship and said it was wiser to stay on board with the lifeboats. This was the first rally that Paluku had held in years, and it ended with him singing. Anyone who thinks the AMP is finished is a liar, he sings, to the same tune and almost the same words as an old song about former President Mobutu Sese Seko's ruling party. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, welcomes the start of a European Union relocation program. Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet has won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for its work in supporting the country's democratization process. And in Burkina Faso, a third member of the leadership party of former President Blaise Compaoré has been arrested. Coming up, music from Mali, and in our feature segment, a group works to promote social and economic justice for young people in Zimbabwe. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off again with African football.
Kim, it'll be a big weekend in African football with the spotlight shining on some high-profile friendly matches as well as first-round 2018 World Cup qualifiers. In World Cup qualifying results Friday, Niger defeated Somalia 2-0 in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Moussa Mazou scored two second-half goals for Niger, the second off a penalty kick in the 62nd minute. The game was played in Ethiopia because of the unstable security situation in Somalia. In neighboring Djibouti Friday, Swaziland got off to a great start in its World Cup qualifying campaign. The Swazis scored a lopsided 6-0 road victory over Djibouti. And I think based on that rousing result, it's safe to say the Swazis will be advancing to the second round after the return leg is played in Swaziland October 13th. In World Cup qualifying results from Thursday, Liberia and visiting Guinea-Bissau drew 1-1 in Monrovia. South Sudan and visiting Mauritania also drew 1-1 in Juba. That match resumed on Thursday after heavy rains in Juba Wednesday forced the game to be stopped after only 10 minutes. And Sao Tome and Principe defeated visiting Ethiopia 1-0. Meanwhile, six more qualifying matches for the 2018 World Cup in Russia are scheduled this weekend in Africa. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma runs down the fixtures for us.
Tomorrow Saturday, Eritrea host Botswana, Chad face Sierra Leone, and the Central African Republic play Madagascar. On Sunday, Malawi host Tanzania, Ethiopia engage Sao Tome and Principe, and Kenya play Mauritius. Elsewhere, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Leopards beat Nigeria's Super Eagles 2-0 in Vize, some 100 kilometers southeast of the Belgian capital, Brussels, on Thursday. Meanwhile, African champions Ivory Coast play hosts Morocco in a friendly match in Agadir today, Friday. Algeria play Guinea, Burkina Faso encounter Mali, and Tunisia face Gabon. On Sunday, Egypt engage Zambia as Nigeria encounter Cameroon. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark, and I'm wishing you a sporty weekend, too.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. way. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 88.9 Villa FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Villa.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
And I know Dr. Larry and my friends at Brilla will be keeping things sporty for me when I visit them next week in Lagos, Nigeria's commercial capital. In more African football news, Ghana will go against Canada at RFK Stadium here in Washington, October 13th, in another international friendly match. Reporter Oral Ofori says it's the first time the teams have met in 30 years.
This game will be the first time both nations are meeting each other on the soccer field after they last played in a friendly encounter 3 decades ago when in 1985, Canada scored a 2-1 victory against Ghana in what was then known as the President's Cup in South Korea. Ghanaians in the American diaspora are very excited about this encounter, with one U.S.-based local Ghanaian language media already urging fans to come out in their numbers to support the Black Stars.
Ghana, 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 what's up? Ghana for more America and Canada. Yesu Yensako. Top Global LLC. And the Ghana Black Stars and by USA. And Ghana versus Canada.
That was an announcement on the Ghanaian radio station in the Ghanaian language of Twi. The station is run by Ghanaians living in the state of Virginia in the USA. The announcement was expressing excitement about the game and urging all to attend, while at the same time thanking Top Global LLC for helping make it a reality. Top Global LLC is the sports management and promotion company responsible for organizing this match. The company, which received the blessings of both the Canada and Ghana soccer authorities, said the October 13th game at the RFK Stadium has taken months to realize. According to Reverend Lord Asante Buedu, the CEO of Top Global LLC, the October break in the FIFA window is what finally allowed for everything to fall in place for this game.
We first started at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, but unfortunately the schedule, because we couldn't put this match on without going with the FIFA scheduling, so coordinating from abroad, because you have to know the national team of Ghana has so many players, about 11 or 12 players are from different clubs. Negotiating with getting them down here was a little bit tough, but all of them are coming. But they also then we have to deal with the schedule as well. And also, the thirdly, we have to deal with the FIFA schedule. All three of them have to be coordinated and be in the same pace. But very fortunate, we were blessed to have the RFK Stadium, which has an open schedule for us to play the game there.
Both nations will use this game as a warm-up as they prepare for their respective qualifiers of the next FIFA World Cup to be held in Russia in 2018. This is Oral Ofori reporting for the Sunny Side of Sports here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening for a look at recent African goal-scoring highlights in Europe.
Yes, Sonny, the goals continue to flow, and instead of starting in England, I'm going to start in Germany, and you've guessed it, it's Mr. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Borussia Dortmund. Now, on the previous Sunny Side of Sport show, we highlighted the fact that he had scored in 7 consecutive matches since the start of the Bundesliga season. And yes, all you listeners, you've got it right. It's now 8 consecutive matches, a truly remarkable, amazing, awesome achievement. The bad news for Aubameyang and his Borussia Dortmund teammates was his goal in the end didn't really matter. They suffered a 5-1 hiding at the champion club, Bayern Munich. But nevertheless, for Aubameyang, a great personal achievement. 8 consecutive league matches, and he has scored in each one of them. In fact, he scored 2 goals in 2 of them. And what price now, Sonny, that he'll make it 9 out of 9 in the foreseeable future? But what is really amazing is, despite this achievement, the preliminary list has been announced for the Ballon d'Or, which is the World Footballer of the Year. Over 50 names, and yet Aubameyang doesn't feature on it. There are 4 Africans: Yaya Toure of Manchester City, very predictable choice; Wilfred Bonny, also of Manchester City, and also a member of the Ivory Coast team that won the Cup of Nations this year. Then you've got Christian Atsu. And I can hear some people saying, "Christian, who?" Well, he's the Ghanaian who won the 2015 Cup of Nations Player of the Tournament. And he did well in that tournament, and he scored the best goal. But really, he's made no impression since. He's on loan from Chelsea to Bournemouth at the moment, and he's not even figuring in the starting lineup. The other Ghanaian in the preliminary list, I think, is well-deserved of his place. That's Andre Ayew. He's doing very well since moving from France to Swansea City. I've no problems with Atsu, Sonny, but I've got a big problem with the fact that Aubameyang, who's been a very consistent scorer, not just this season, but last season, and he's also the star of the Gabonese team, I think he was worthy of a place in that preliminary list.
I think he was worthy of a place too, David. The Gabonese striker, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, has proven to be one of the big stars this season in the German Bundesliga. Finally, in women's professional basketball, the WNBA Finals resume later Friday night in Indianapolis, Indiana. The Indiana Fever will host the Minnesota Lynx in Game 3 of the best-of-5 championship series, which is tied at 1-1. Our VOA basketball fans will remember this is a rematch of the 2012 WNBA Finals, which Indiana won 3-1. In Game 2 Tuesday night, Minnesota evened the series with a 77-71 victory at home. Center Sylvia Fowles led Minnesota with a game-high 21 points and 9 rebounds. The Fever is bidding for its second WNBA trophy after that title in 2012, while the Lynx is looking to win its 3rd WNBA championship after earlier titles in 2011 and 2013. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, we focus on a group working to promote social and economic justice for young people in Zimbabwe. And next, months after a coup attempt, Burundi's independent media still remains off the air. But first, some music. Here is Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo Yambo.
Nadokela, don't get to be alone. Nadokela, don't get to be alone.
Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo Yambo.
The United Nations has moved to improve youth participation at the recent annual meeting of the UN General Assembly. At the meeting, young people from Zimbabwe met on the sidelines with youth from other countries. Reporter Blessing Zulu talked with human rights activist Beatrice Savadaye, who is also the director of a group working to promote social and economic justice for young people in Zimbabwe.
Tell us about the meetings that you are attending at the United Nations General Assembly.
I came here to attend a side session that was happening alongside the United Nations General Assembly, which was focusing on young people leading change and looking at the sustainable development goals and what they mean for young people and what the role that young people can play in ensuring that we secure the SDGs. So what we were doing is we were young people from different communities, and particularly what we talked about was that there is need for involvement and participation, meaningful involvement and participation of young people to in all spheres and in all spaces of decision making to ensure that we are part of the implementation, the planning, the implementation of Millennium Development Goals, and also the part of the monitoring and evaluation of those goals. And most importantly, that we need to mobilize young people to be excited about SDGs now, not leaving anybody behind, and ensuring that we end HIV by 2030 and that there's universal access of sexual and reproductive health information and services by all. as a young person from Zimbabwe, I'm concerned about the many young girls who are being married off every day. Globally, statistics show that 15 million girls are married annually, and that's more like the population of Zimbabwe. So if we, and in Zimbabwe particularly, 31% of girls are married before they reach the age of 18. So already if we have 31% of our girls in Zimbabwe being married off in, and getting into these institutions where they're not able to negotiate for safer sex and they're at risk of contracting HIV, we are already leaving a huge part of the population behind.
But looking at Zimbabwe, what would you consider to be the major challenges when it comes to achieving the SDGs?
I think the major challenge that we have is the economic crisis that we are in. Much as, and we need to have the political will to engage and involve young people in the implementation. I think world over we are experiencing the youth bulge, where we have half of the world's population being young people. So people who cannot afford user fees that are needed at the health institutions, people cannot finance for their own health. We have people who are traveling more than 20 kilometers to get to a health center. So it's really problematic in terms of us meeting the goals and being able to implement them because of the economic situation that we are in.
Do you feel the world leaders are now taking you seriously?
Young people were heavily consulted on the Sustainable Development Goals, and I think it's one of the huge, most huge exercises that has ever been carried out, where young people were really, engaged. But the challenge now is in the implementation of Sustainable Development Goals. Are countries going, when they're going to develop their national strategies, are they going to involve young people in the implementation of that? Do countries have policies that friendly to young people participating in such kind of decision making? So you find that the challenges will come at country level when we don't have policies and laws that allow young people to participate in such important issues. Young people will still be left behind.
That was Beatrice Abadaye talking to VOA's Blessing Zulu.
Four months after a coup attempt, Burundi's independent media remains off the air. As Mohamed Yusuf reports, the population is frustrated and is using social media to try to fill the gap, but often receives rumors in the place of what is actually happening. Mohamed Yusuf has more.
On May 13th, a group of soldiers attempted to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza's government. 2 days later, the coup was foiled, and some independent media outlets like Radio Bonesha and Radio Public African were attacked and banned. Many other stations and newspapers shut down, and their staff fled to neighbouring countries. 4.5 months later, the only working radio and TV stations are government-owned. Meanwhile, officials are investigating the private media for allegedly promoting violence and anti-government messages during the coup attempt and the re-election of the president to a controversial third term. Antoine Kaburahe is the managing director of the Iwachu newspaper, the only remaining independent media outlet in Burundi. He says the government prefers having the airwaves to itself.
The government says that there is an investigation, but we know that there is no investigation. And the investigation can be done and media working. But we are convinced that government don't let independent media working. So now there is only government media who is working, the radio and the television, public, but they are not public, they are doing propaganda.
Kaburahe says the few remaining journalists are operating in a hostile political environment. Human rights organizations have warned the journalism field in Burundi has become increasingly dangerous. The rights groups accuse authorities of denying journalists access to some neighborhoods where the government is cracking down on anti-government protesters. Bujumbura resident Joan Batista tells VOA it has been hard to get reliable news and information on what is happening in his country.
It
is very hard to get news in Burundi, he says. The only media working is the government-owned radio station, and they do not tell exactly what is happening in the country. He says it is very difficult to get news unless you are at the scene and witness what is happening. Burundians have resorted to sharing news through social media, which some blame for further inflaming the situation. Kaburahe says that is what you get when you shut the media and people have no access to the information.
There are many rumors of people will be killed or there will be attacks. And I think this is the consequences of the silence of the independent media. So everybody put on WhatsApp every information, truth or not, and there is a fear. There is fear.
In August, the Committee to Protect Journalists and 18 other organizations urged Burundian authorities to investigate attack on journalists and human rights defenders. Burundian authorities were not available for comment. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes Mozambique's recent announcement that it has completed clearance of all known fields of landmines in the country. Since 1993, when Mozambique emerged from decades of conflict as one of the world's most landmine-affected nations, the United States has been proud to partner with the people of Mozambique, investing more than $55 million toward improving the safety and security of local communities through the U.S. Conventional Weapons Destruction Program. Through that partnership, which includes the international donor community and humanitarian demining organizations, we have worked diligently to safely clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, prevent injuries through community outreach and education, and provide medical and social services to survivors of accidents involving these legacies of past conflicts. The United States is proud to be the world's leading provider of financial and technical assistance to help countries address this serious humanitarian challenge. Since 1993, we have invested approximately $2.5 billion in aid in more than 90 countries to decrease the threat posed by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Our efforts have dramatically reduced the world's annual landmine casualty rate and helped 16 countries declare themselves landmine free. Humanitarian demining in places like Mozambique sets the stage for post-conflict recovery and development. It is another important way in which the United States promotes international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.